Tales of a Well-Established Lesbian. Chapter 52. All of a sudden, the end of another year is approaching. Christmas comes round fast, doesn't it? I mean, especially if you waited until September to celebrate the last one. And this year, I'm kicking off the month of festivities with some roller derby involvement at long last. True to my word, I've stayed away from our team and I've let Ashley just do her thing. And, well, in the meantime, she's raised her game so much that she had finally gone and joined the more advanced team across town. And she hadn't stopped there. Both Ash and Bea had made their national teams just in time for the Roller Derby World Cup. Not that Ash being around would have been such an issue, to be honest. We've kind of settled into this sort of weird rhythm of hanging out a couple of times a week. It's all very undefined and the lines are a bit blurry. But with Ash officially on another team, it's a lot easier for me to get involved again. Now Betty, as always, is working her arse off to create a Christmas-themed game day. I'll volunteer my services, you know, general dog's body. And then, a little closer to the event, I got promoted to DJ, which is an unexpected move. Betty has clearly never been subjected to one of my playlists. Even if I might be the worst DJ ever, I'm very glad of the chance to get out of the house and be around some people. And especially these people. I gotta say, I love watching my friends kick ass on track. There's something really, really fun about it. I know them. Look at that brilliant one. I know her. There's just something really fun about it. And now, armed with a playlist that never ends, I am ready to rock on game day. Betty and I do our usual Chuckle Brothers routine whilst laying the track. Whenever we do this, there is always a moment that Betty is convinced that we have got it upside down. And I, without fail, will always reassure her that we haven't. Except for that one time that we had got it upside down. It was fine. It's all fine. You know, game day production is actually a massive job. And like everything else in roller derby, it's done by volunteers. There's a DIY ethos through and through. Boyfriends, girlfriends, mums, dads, siblings, aunts, mates, next door neighbours, everyone gets roped in. Programmes are designed and printed, tickets sold online and on the door. There is always a cake store, heaven help you if there isn't. Merch will be made and sold. A venue has to be hired, professional medics, ready to sit around for a few hours watching crazy people throw themselves at each other. Gameplay contracts need to be exchanged between teams. Oh, and then you need to find two crews of people, specific people, in fact. The first crowd are referees, or as we like to affectionately call them, zebras. Ideally, you're gonna want about seven of these, and then you're gonna need the other crew of NSOs. These are non-skating officials, and you're gonna want to round up approximately 10 of these. So it's fair to say it's a pretty full-on event to try and run. But I'll be honest, once everything's set up and the doors are open, that's when you can start to relax. Now, all I've got to do for the rest of the day is press play, press pause, and turn the volume down when the head referee gets mad that they can't hear themselves think. Because I am not the super organised Betty, I've completely forgotten about the fact that there will be an announcer for the games. As a small league, we don't actually have our own announcer, so I'm really intrigued to find out who they've roped in for the job. And the job itself is kind of part MC, part commentator, part public service announcements. They are very useful to have. Phoebe and Marco are also super involved on game days. Phoebe volunteers Marco for all sorts of things. But it's not just her boyfriend she's roped in this time. It turns out that Phoebe has talked our fabulous Monday night quizmaster into doing some announcing for us. Shane, who truly is a fantastic quiz host, is up for the challenge. But when I see him, he's looking just a little bit more nervous than I've ever seen him looking before. And he's watching the skaters currently warming up and getting paler. I'll pop over to say hello and help him get his mic sorted. Shane does not seem to be relaxing, so I try to make a little bit of small talk. So, you watch much roller derby, Shane? Oh right, wow, this is your first game Like ever. What, not just like live? Oh, right. Yeah, no, I'm sure you're going to absolutely love it, you know. How do I put this? Do you know how it works? Like the game, the rules, that sort of stuff. Yep. No, all right, nothing to worry about. No, I mean, we've got 15 minutes. I'm sure we can just run through the basics with you right now. Whew. Shane actually knows less than nothing about roller derby, because what he does know is wrong. And my attempts to break down the basic lingo he's gonna need is just making him more confused and a little panicky, if I'm honest. I reassure him that I am gonna be right here, right next to him at the DJ table, if he needs to check anything or ask anything. But I remind him that he has energies for days. Nobody can engage like he does. And in fact, he will have no problem getting the 24 relatives of the people on track who make up today's crowd on board. I have no doubts about it. It seems that my 101 into roller derby hasn't actually helped Shane, and he's getting more and more nervous about trying to understand the gameplay. And then the sound guy pipes up. We've got two mics, you know. You could both have a go at it. Shane looks at me like all of his prayers have been answered. I look at the sound guy like, yeah, thanks for that. First whistle is now imminent. I don't have much time to decide if I'm going to do this. But looking at Shane's face, I am not sure I can possibly refuse. Ah, but what's the worst that can happen? If we're terrible, we'll just sit down at halftime and be quiet. But as it goes, we don't need to. Shane and I form a lovely partnership, riffing off each other, bouncing off each other. I explain the action on track, Shane adds some colour, and with Shane knowing nothing about the game, I can sort of educate him and the crowd at the same time. All of those hours watching games on YouTube are finally paying off for me. I am channeling every announcer I have ever heard. I think I have used every single one of their catchphrases so far this afternoon. But the best discovery about the whole thing is how it changes how I watch a game. Honestly, I feel so involved right now. I am getting caught up and swept along in the action. I suddenly understand why commentators lose their minds at times. And I too let my excitement come through on the microphone. Now Shane does a superb job, and a very professional one, at the half times. There are two of those. There's a double header today, two games back to back. And our raffle ticket sales are off the charts. Our best moment comes when we manage to get the entire hall involved in a sing-along to Frozen's Let It Go. Shane had refused to believe that I know every word. He knows better now. Honestly, by the end of the day, I am exhausted. My throat is absolutely killing me. I feel like I've actually played a game myself. But it was brilliant, and I love it. And I think I might need to find out how one might go about becoming an announcer. Because this announcing business is fun. And I can't shut up about it, even though I've spent all day talking, when I tell Ashley all about it. And we're hanging out again and again. And I'm not going to lie to you, it's complicated. It really is. Like, we're not together, but there's stuff going on, and I don't think either of us can define it. Whether we're just hanging out watching the latest David Attenborough documentary series, or heading down to see the canal boats all dressed up in their Christmas lights, we're like Schrodinger's couple, simultaneously together and apart. And personally, I'm confused as hell. And I know I'm not helping myself. I mean, all of this is obviously a terrible idea. Nothing good comes back from the dead. I mean, you only ever get zombies, right? And a zombie relationship sounds terrible. It's going to look like the relationship you knew, but it's not going to stay fresh for very long. And you're probably going to get your brains eaten in the process. But, and this is the bit that always gets me. What if she's actually changing? What if things can be different? Like, would I be a complete fool not to give that a chance, not to give Ashley another chance. Or maybe I'm just being really weak. Maybe I'm just shit scared about this whole starting again thing. Maybe I'm just clinging to the familiar. But it's hard not to have that hope when Ashley really is making an effort. You know, even at our team Christmas party, which of course she's welcome to as well, Ash is actually on great form. Not mad, over the top, attention seeking form, like great form. It's such an easy night. Like, everyone seems more comfortable around the pair of us when we're getting on well too. So all in all, it's been lovely. And fair play to my mates, they are doing a great job of walking the fine line between being supportive and checking that I'm not doing the wrong thing for the wrong reasons. I think it's easier to hear that stuff when you know people have your best interests at heart, and that even if you make the wrong decision in their eyes, they're still going to be there for you. Now somehow, Ashley and I end up going Christmas shopping together. I think it's because Ashley hasn't actually had to choose a present for her mum for years, because I always did the gift selection. And with just 2 days to go, Ashley still has no clues. And for me, I'm doing my shopping early this year, on the 23rd, instead of Christmas Eve. I know. So ahead of schedule, so organised. Now, every year, we all have the same discussions, don't we, about Christmas. You know, you've got those early shoppers, the ones who are done by August. These are the ones who are always so horrified by my approach. Personally though, I can never understand why the set of smellies they've bought everyone has to be purchased quite so early. But hey, each to their own. I just can't be buying Christmas presents until it feels Christmassy. It's just weird to me. Now this year, I'm really struggling for that Christmassy feeling. I'm really worried that Christmas is going to feel a lot like that snow day I had the other day. I got up, I was so excited, and then I realised I had no one to share the snow with. I had no one to go and run in and wake up excitedly and tell them it was snowing, even though they didn't care. Nothing. I'm cut off in another town over from everyone else. I mean, I still went out and built a snowman, but of course it just wasn't as fun on my own. And I really don't want Christmas Day to feel like that. As Ashley and I are finishing up our Christmas shopping, we stumble across a lovely little jewellery store outside. All of their stuff is handmade from coins and cutlery and basically anything else the makers can get their hands on and turn into jewellery. In a shocking twist, they had rings that actually fit my tiny fingers. And before I can say no, don't, Ashley's bought me the ring I've been admiring. It's a lovely moment at the end of a lovely day, and it's giving me hope that my Christmas plans are going to go off without a hitch. Because you see, after Ashley and I spend Christmas Eve with Phoebe and Marco, we're going to be having Christmas dinner together with a special guest, Paul. That's right, me, Ashley and Paul. That's the grand plan for the 25th of December. We're going to play Happy Families, eat dinner, and maybe even watch the Queen's speech for once. Obviously, this has the potential to go horribly wrong, but it's a chance I'm willing to take. Otherwise, all three of us will be sat alone like sad bastards on Christmas Day. Especially Paul, because he bloody hates Christmas. He doesn't particularly like his family. He doesn't ever want to spend it with them. He'd rather sit at home and do sod all. And I can't be having that. For Ash and I, we won't be seeing our parents until Boxing Day. Hers, because that's when they always do it. Mine, because, well, they've decided to gut their house and they don't have a kitchen, so they've gone off to stay in some little cottage somewhere. As you do. I'm almost certain that these two, Paul and Ashley, can manage to get along for 4 or 6 hours together. I'm sure it's going to be fine. Right? Well... No, I'm actually, though, for once, I am kidding. We have a lovely day. It is great. And don't get me wrong, the pair of them wound each other up like you wouldn't believe for most of the day, but it was actually in quite good humour. And it really helped having Paul there. It kept it from feeling like Ashley and I had just slipped back into our old ways. It helped keep a little bit of distance between us. And I feel like if this continues between us, then maybe it can be different than before. Because that's the big question for me, right? Can it ever really be different? Or are we just going to end up repeating history? The effort that Ashley's been making makes me feel even more like it can. And roller derby has been a huge part of helping her really make those changes stick. She's hitting the gym instead of the bar, and it seems that some of her other vices have dropped too. She says she's been attending meetings, and she says they've really helped. And I've got to be honest, I'm impressed. It seems like real and sustained effort. And it's not just on track for roller derby either. It's for everything. Renee throws a New Year's Eve party and Ash comes with me. And there's not a drop of drama. I know it can't have been an easy night for her. You know, I felt the cold shoulder from some of the people who are blatantly Team Ashley when we've been in situations recently. And I'm sure she was worried about that happening with my friends. But she needn't have, because they're wonderful. So we've brought in the new year, and it does feel like there's a chance of a reset, of a fresh start. Some part of me wants that, you know, to be the couple that makes a comeback. But the other part of me doesn't really believe it's possible, real or true. And I don't really feel like I can trust my own judgment right now. A December full of distractions have helped me get through the month, but the cracks have been getting wider in my mind, and I'm falling in more and more often. A cold, dark, miserable January doesn't help. It's always the longest month ever. And this time, it's full of consultations about when and how we're going to be out of a job. Skills sessions to help us find work after, and any other activity they can think of that's basically forcing me to consider my next move. I don't really care. I don't know what I want to do. And everything I come up with feels futile and pointless. You know, everything I've done for the last 7 years is to try and climb this so-called ladder. You know, ticking the right boxes, the proper job, the proper life, you know, the holidays and the cars and the house. And for what? To be tossed out on my ear just when I finally get my foot onto a decent rung of it. And it's not the first time it's happened either. And I'm bloody certain it's not going to be the last. My wonderful boss, and I do genuinely mean that, she's not a stupid woman. And I'm pretty sure she's got a better idea of what's going on with me than I do. And she's concerned, because apparently I have stopped fighting her on anything. And I kind of do that a lot. I push back a lot. Now, she says technically she's got no complaints, I'm doing my job well, but the apathy is a new thing and it's worrying her. Okay. Yep, I hear her. It's just January, I say. You know, it's just life, I say. You know what's going on. It's all a lot, isn't it? Don't worry, boss. I've got a week coming up and I'm sure that little break is gonna help. She does not look remotely reassured. Unlike me, she is not believing my fibs, because I am convinced that this time off is going to help. And why do I think this? Because I'm going to the Roller Derby World Cup. And in what glamorous, far-flung destination will the women of the Roller Derby world be assembling? None other than our very own Manchester. The Americans can't believe it. The Europeans are buzzing about it. The Australians and Narotoa and the like are still screwed, to be honest with you, so they remain indifferent. It's kind of fair. And once we get there, I can totally see why the organisers won the bid to host. In an enormous convention centre, they have transformed it with the help of the most incredible team of volunteers, all in their gorgeous yellow t-shirts. These lot have built 3 tracks, 2 warm-up tracks, a whole bunch of grandstands, a shopping village and a food alley. It is impressive as hell. And there are 4 days of roller derby to get underway. Honestly, I can't bloody wait. It's just so good. Even the crafters in the next convention hall kept trying to sneak in to see what on earth was going on. What are all these random people doing, and why are half of them wearing skates and covered in safety gear? I have never in my life watched as much roller derby as I did over those 4 days. Betty, Clyde and I cheered hard for Ash and Bea as they represented their country, winning first time out. I was very glad we'd made our supporter signs because they both gave us plenty to cheer about. Now, our homeland Wales were smashing their way through the stages of the tournament until they drew down one of the big teams, Team USA. And it was our tiny nation up against the might of Team USA. These lot are like as close to pros as you're going to get in our game. USA, England and Australia are the big dogs of our sport and are most likely top three. That's if Canada or Aotearoa can't cause an upset. Wales performed amazingly in their loss to the USA. I mean, honestly, they played their hearts out and I barely had a voice left by the time the whole thing was over. Next up for our nation was head-to-head with Scotland, and it ended up being twice in a row because of the way the draw worked. We beat them both times. Team Mexico stole my heart, and basically so did all of the underdog teams. I mean, that is ultimately my favourite sports narrative. However, 4 days of roller derby is a lot. I never thought I would ever say such a thing. But as Betty and I settle in to watch the final, we are almost done in. A little bit broken, if I'm honest with you. As soon as this game is done, we are heading straight for home. Like, get me in the car, why isn't teleportation a thing? And thanks to some random delays, I am proper flagging by the time the final gets underway. And I'm bloody starving. But at this point, all of the food vendors have packed up and they've gone home. What am I going to do? Hold on, Betty, I've got an idea. Timing is important in love, comedy and pizza delivery. I could have kissed the Domino's delivery driver when he pulled up outside the convention centre with just 5 minutes of half time remaining. Our seats are at the top of one of the grandstands and hundreds of pairs of eyes follow me and my pizzas all the way back to my seat. The jealousy was very, very real. I felt proper smug. But thankfully, the roller derby started back up before the crowd could get ugly. Honestly, it had been an amazing event. They had done themselves proud hosting 33 nations in a very slickly run World Cup. The BBC had picked up the feed and they had been showing the nation what roller derby was all about. I'd been paying particular attention to the announcers, and maybe I joked in 4 years' time, I'd have a part to play in a World Cup, a little something to say. I mean, after all, who knows where life's going to take me, right? Because that is the question that continues to bloody haunt me. Because all that's in front of me now is the end of my job and waiting for the house that I'm sort of squatting in to be sold. Lost is a bit of an understatement, if I'm honest with you, and my whole ignoring it strategy not working so well. Every time I slip into a bad chain of thought, I get deeper and deeper into this catastrophic way of thinking. I can sort of hold it all together when I need to for like work or socialising, but after that, on my own, I just don't seem to be able to stand the chance. I'm like so aware of myself, but completely unable to do anything about it. And I'm more and more exhausted each time I have to pull myself together and wipe away my tears and try and get on with things. And it's not like I don't have good reasons to be sad and all down in the dumps, obviously. I mean, look at my circumstances. Things aren't exactly ideal, but that's not explaining how dark and exhausting it feels right now. Like, I can't explain how hard it is to push forward when it feels like you've got your own backseat driver undermining every single little choice you make or think that you might make. All it ever seems to end up ultimately saying is, what's the point? And honestly, I feel like I'm going fucking mad. like up and down at the slightest thing, and the down just keeps getting deeper. Like, this isn't all new for me, right? I've dealt with depression and anxiety before. You've heard it raise its ugly head since my teenage years, and it's not only me who struggled with this in this life. I know that a lot of us do. And in fact, both of my parents have been affected over the years, and I've seen the impact it's had on them. And the impact it had on them had an impact on me too. I quickly decided I want to win at life, yes, but not at all costs. I'd long ago deemed the cost too high a price to pay from my own personal experience. Now, all of this and more has fed into my ideas around depression and how to treat it. My ideas around antidepressants and medication in general as a form of treatment. I don't really have a lot of belief in their effectiveness. And I do have a lot of belief that they can be really difficult to get off. And of course, being the pop psychologist that Dawson's Creek has taught me to be, I've diagnosed myself with an addictive personality too. So surely antidepressants aren't for me. But thanks though. How are these little tablets going to help when, regardless of whether or not I take them, my life is still a messy, confused beast of a thing? If I pop these pills, all of that isn't suddenly going to get straightened out, is it? No. So what's the point? I don't really see myself as someone who needs them. Like, come on, I can fix this. You know, just pull myself together. Just come on now. And I keep telling myself this despite the evidence that over the last 6 weeks, I really, really can't. And I don't know how I can believe my own lies when there's no part of me that hasn't been dealing with suicidal ideation. Like, it's zero intention. Zero intention. But all of the thoughts are more in that vein of, like, just not wanting to be, right? You know, you forget that waking up and wishing that you didn't exist isn't normal. I mean, I grant you, I don't normally just bounce out of bed and feel joy at being alive. But I also don't generally feel disappointed about the fact that I'm still breathing. So I push on, honestly. I ignore it the best I can when I need to function. And I give in when it's too much. I'll tell you, someone who doesn't believe my lies is my mum. I guess over the years, they have honed their parental skills so that they can tell what my true mood is after about 30 seconds of any conversation. They've learnt to read my voice like a book. And it makes it quite hard when you want to do some protecting of them. I don't want them worrying about me right now. I know, they're my parents and they're going to worry about me and they're going to want to protect me, but this mess is all of my own doing and I don't see why they need to have to deal with it. But there's that one day when my mum finds the right enough moment and asks how bad things really are with me. She obviously knows. And yet she guides me gently to the realisation that now might be the time to seek some help. As much as I agree with her, my assumptions around treatment come to the fore. You know, I know they're just going to give me some pills and send me on my way and I'll get stuck on them forever. I'm terrified of the thought of not being able to feel anything, of ending up completely numb, of becoming one of those zombies. Patiently, my mum helps me unpick my thoughts. A lot of what I think I know and the experience I had is nearly 20 years old now. Medications have changed, support has changed. Even the stigma of the whole thing, it's out in the open now and slowly that's changing too. So why am I so unwilling to give myself the best chance I can to get better or feel better? Mum reminds me of the lengths I'd gone to, attempting to recover from an elbow injury years ago. All of the rehab I'd done, all the sorts of different treatments I'd tried, even that very 90s homeopathic nonsense. You know, I'd been open to all of it if I thought it was going to get me where I needed to be. At least talk to the doctor about your options, my mum said. You know, just give yourself a fighting chance. And that's how she described them to me, the antidepressants, as something to give me a chance to get my head above water for a while. And I do hear what she's saying, and it makes sense. And I know I can believe it coming from her. But I'm struggling with it. Doctors, well, GPs, they haven't exactly been the best in my personal experience. They're so often really dismissive and hurried. And it's hard to believe that they're going to be any less so about a mental health issue. It takes me another two more long, awful nights and one day when I completely lose the plot to realise that whatever is going on with me is kicking my ass. And I'm losing the fight, if I'm honest. It's time for a bit of backup because I can't do this on my own anymore. And so I pick up the phone and I make that doctor's appointment. Awkwardly, I'm still registered with the little village doctor surgery from when Ashley and I first moved up here. I mean, but they've not been the worst doctors I've ever had, so I'm just not going to tell them I've moved. The sweat is pouring off me as I sit in the waiting room. I'll never understand how it is that the place is absolutely empty, but the doctor is still late for my appointment. As I'm kept waiting, a cat strolls into reception. He looks at me, checks that I'm not about to shoo him out of the door, and then curls up on one of the big comfy chairs. I don't have the heart to tell him that the vet's is two doors up. My doc seems as surprised as me when she comes out to call me in. He's not with me, I assure her, and we leave the cat to snooze in the waiting room and head into her office. When she asks how she can help me today, my mind goes blank. Luckily, I am prepared for this possibility, which, of course, is my mum's idea. What I've done is I've written everything down in one of those moments where I could actually articulate it. And it turned out to be a godsend, because right now I'm not forgetting anything and I'm not falling apart whilst I'm trying to explain it to her. I've gotten pretty lucky with the doc too. She's actually listening. She really nicely explains my options to me and talks me through the medication she's proposing. How it works, how it's going to be managed, and I'm stunned. I don't actually have many valid assumptions left by the time I drive to the pharmacy to fill my prescription. What I do feel like is a bit of an idiot for having waited so long to go and talk to someone, to go and get some help. Especially when the doc signs me off work for 2 weeks. I'd just sort of expected they'd give me some tablets, I'd take them and carry on. But the doc didn't think that was a very good idea. She said I needed to stop. Try and rest, she says. Even if we just take work away, that's one less set of things to worry about. Something about the way the doc took me seriously made me take it more seriously. And I realised this too shall pass, but there are things I can do to help it go along a little quicker. By first acknowledging it, and then by realising that my life doesn't need to tick certain boxes for me to qualify for depression. I'm a bugger for looking around and seeing those who have it worse and denying that I have any right to feel any kind of way about my station in life. I hate the fact that logically and rationally I get it, I understand my depression, but I can't seem to take any action that helps me, and it's that contradiction that is so frustrating. So the doctors, and now the medication, they're big steps for me. And I'll be honest, all I'm really worried about now is telling my boss I'm going to be off work for 2 weeks. Which of course was silly, because she's been nothing but supportive, and that hasn't changed in the slightest. Which means I can take a deep breath and show myself a little self-care. You know, that proper self-care, you know, where you get out in the fresh air, you eat better. I'm sad to report that Domino's alone is not enough to sustain a human being. You're going to need to mix in at least a KFC or two as well. Please don't take nutritional advice from me. And of course, it wouldn't be self-care if there wasn't at least a giant bubble bath or five. Best of all though, I was talking stuff through. And I was talking it through with Paul. The big stuff, the little stuff, didn't matter. We talked about it all. And talking doesn't always help, like, immediately. Sometimes it does. It takes me a while to untangle things and I have to come back to it a few times. So it's not ideal when Paul, very selfishly, announces that he's abandoning me to take his dream trip to America. So not only is he not taking me with him and leaving me at home, he has now got the cheek to ask me to cat-sit. Liberties, people. Booking liberties. But luckily for Paul, I bloody love his cat, Simon. Possibly more than I love Paul. So Simon is going to come and live with me for the next 3 weeks. I really hope Paul has briefed him on the likelihood of me using him for an emotional support animal while he's here. Not that he'd be bothered, because Simon is the most chilled out cat in existence. Honestly, even when he gets into trouble, he does it in this languid and lazy sort of way. He is literally no bother, unlike his owner. Paul drops Simon off late the night before his flight. Now, Paul loves a gadget, so of course, Simon has an automatic feeder. All I've got to do is fill it once a day and the machine will divvy it out to the greedy little fur bag who otherwise would eat it all for breakfast if he could. I give Simon the tour and it turns out he really likes the skylights and lying right in the middle of the stairs. Such a cat. He settles down for the night with no bother at all. Honestly, he's adorable. Off I go to bed. 1 minute, I am fast asleep, warm and cosy, and quite probably having lovely dreams. The next, I am sat bolt upright, because Paul is in the house and he is yelling for Simon. What the actual fuck is going on? I grab my phone. It is 6 o'clock in the morning. What is this wanker's problem? I'm livid. I'm fucking livid. I heard Simon go clattering down to the kitchen after the first shout. But that hadn't shut Paul up. Oh no, he just kept on shouting, "Simon, come and get your biscuits, Simon." Oh, he thinks he's so funny. Can't believe he's turned up here at 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm a swing for him. Except the kitchen is empty. Oh, ha ha. You're so funny. You're going to jump out of the downstairs loo and scare me. Aha ha. Yeah, yeah, you're hilarious. Except that's empty too. And the front door is locked. I check the patio doors and they're still locked with the key still in there. Now all the love in the world to Paul, he's definitely not come through that tiny kitchen window. I'm fucking perplexed. And right now, I am completely weirded out. Simon is loving his breakfast, not a care in the world. I have no idea what is going on. Bollocks to this, I think. I'm going back to bed. And then at 9 a.m, the same thing happens. I pelt it downstairs at the sound of Paul's voice. I fucking got him this time. I burst into the kitchen so hard I have to talk Simon down off the top of the fridge. I stand there staring at the automatic feeder as it whirs round to its next section, listening to a recording of Paul. "Simon, come and get your biscuits. Simon, come and get your biscuits." Bastard. 5 times a day. For 3 weeks, that wanker's voice rang out in my house. "Simon, can you make it?" I can hear that boy laughing all the way from Nashville. I swear, I hope a girl in a pair of Daisy Dukes breaks his heart, or at least a pair of his sunglasses. Hello, how you doing? I hope all is well with you. And given this week's chapter, if it's not, that's okay too, because let's be honest, sometimes it does go like that. So what I'd really like you to do is cut yourself some slack, ask for some help, and whatever you do, don't be ashamed. Life is tough and everyone needs some backup from time to time. Now, I am not going to try and sit here and list the relevant services in all 75 countries that you wonderful folks are in. But trust me, help is out there and it does get better. That's it for this week. After all, you know where to find me on the socials. You know how much your rankings and reviews help the show. And you know that if you donate and subscribe, it helps keep the show ad-free. So I'm going to save you the usual spiel. You know where to find the info. What I do want to say is thank you, as always, for the privilege of your time. And whatever you're up to this week, please take care of you.